Hello, and welcome to this week's The Proteomics Show. This is a special limited series of The Proteomics Show sponsored by US HUPO called The Road to Chicago, where we talk to people coming to Chicago.
And I'm Ben Osborne, and I'm here with the coldest guy in Chicago, Dr. Benjamin Neely. And this episode, we speak with Dr. Milan Merksich, who's the Vice President of Research at Northwestern University here in Chicago.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun talking about array technology and all the cool stuff he's doing. And my favorite part is that he repeatedly said he's not where he was supposed to be, yet he's the VP of Research. So he has a really cool story, does a lot of cool research. Enjoy. Milan, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Ben.
Yeah, so we're just going to hop right into it. So this is part of our Road to Chicago, which you are actually in Chicago currently. And you don't need to talk about what you're going to talk about there, but can you tell us a little bit about what you do? And I know you do like a lot of things, so just kind of go into that if you would.
Well, one of the themes that my lab has really been an expert in, focused in for 25 years now, is surface chemistry and surfaces that are biologically active, and learning how to create surfaces that have biological properties, that have a lot of control over what they interact with. And one of the principal applications and directions that we've applied that to is in assays or testing enzyme activity, testing protein binding activities, a whole range of biochemical activities. And so we've really developed chemistries for controlling the structures and properties of surfaces, and then extended that into applications having to do with measuring biochemical activities, what we call assays, and then a whole range of areas that are relevant to understanding how cells interact with man-made surfaces.
Wow. Okay. So I had a bunch of questions, but when we start thinking surface chemistry and proteomics, I think that's a Venn diagram that doesn't have a lot. Right. But it sounds like it must then.
You know, it's interesting. Whenever you sample a biological fluid, oftentimes a fluid that, comes from a person, blood or saliva or others, it can't be done in a vacuum. You apply that fluid to a material, whether it's a strip test, the kinds of things that we've all gotten familiar with in at-home rapid tests for COVID, pregnancy tests, or whether you're looking in the clinical diagnostic laboratories and hospitals, there is a material involved, and the material has to interact with that specific protein or other molecule that you're analyzing in a complex fluid, and has to have a way of reporting whether that activity or that molecule is present. So material science and surface chemistry can't be avoided. They're really at that interface where the action happens.
Okay. How big are these effects at a proteomic level? I mean, is this a small effect? Is this a small percentage of things, or are we talking a lot?
I think virtually, most of what we do involves applying samples to materials. Now, to be clear, there are a lot of mass spectrometry methods that are, many of the high-tech drivers in proteomics, where the purpose of the material is to not interact with the proteins so that they stay in solution, they can get injected into the instrument and analyzed. But many of the assays that are used in diagnostics in the hospital, in high-throughput screening, a really critical technology that is involved in the early stages of developing drugs, new drugs, the materials that are used are critical. And we can talk as we get into this about the high throughput screening application, which is really probably the area that our science has had the most significant impact.
So, and excuse me, because I probably should have been doing more research, but like, are we talking lectin arrays or like oligoarrays, or, you say like binding things, I'm thinking old DNA microarrays, but what, like, is this just universally a surface chemistry for all these things, or is there something you're really focused on?
It's a really good question, Ben. And the surface chemistries we've developed, and these are based on self-assembled monolayers of alkane thiolates on gold, these have been relevant broadly. So as you note, oligonucleotide arrays were the first array-based technology that were really important, both in basic research and university and government research labs, and as a technology, you know, starting with Affymetrix and progressing through Illumina, which is, you know, established itself as the market leader. And in all these cases, you've got surfaces that have biomolecules attached to them, typically in arrays. So it's a different biomolecule in each region or dot on the surface. And these are then capable of interacting with their partners in a sample. And the magic of the arrays is that, you know, in the time and effort it took to do a couple of experiments with a given amount of sample, it became possible to do thousands and then hundreds of thousands. And indeed, today, hundreds of millions of tests with the same sample, because the surface has a checkerboard of that number of regions that each test for something else. And, you know, one of the things that really got us into this area was developing surfaces that have the property that they prevent nonspecific protein adsorption. Proteins adsorb to basically all synthetic surfaces. And that's a problem if you're looking for specific interactions, if you're trying to measure a protein binding, because if everything is binding nonspecifically, you can't pick out what you're looking for. And as a postdoc with George Whitesides at Harvard, we really learned how to develop these so-called inert surface chemistries. And then in my lab, when I got started at the University of Chicago as an assistant professor, that was really the starting point where we combined those inert surface chemistries with new bioconjugation chemistries that gave us a lot of control in covalently attaching biomolecules to the surface and bringing those together with patterning methods that let us create arrays. And that was really the foundation of much of what we've done over the past couple decades.
Wow. And so,
okay, just to check a number, you said hundreds of millions. That's like, we're talking E8s.
These are, you know,
well, zero.
It's a mind blowing number. It really is. But, you know, when David Walt, at the time at Tufts University, co-founded Illumina, they were creating DNA arrays based on a self-assembly process, beads, where each bead had a different oligonucleotide or peptide sequence on it, just settled into dimples on a substrate. It was based on fiber optic arrays, but it settled in and it created an array. Now, it was interesting because it was a random array. Nobody knew which oligo sequence was in each spot, but they had some really elegant methods to decode the array so that they then assigned the positions of every possible molecule. And as they advanced that technology by going to smaller beads, they literally got to hundreds of millions of assays on a single substrate, and that became a commercial technology. So it really is remarkable when you see, you know, the growth. It kind of is the Moore's law that's governed growth of transistor density and computing performance and semiconductor technologies. And we've seen that happen in applied biology.
Man, I remember those days where, like, you had to figure out what the probe was. We actually, the building I was in, we printed arrays. And I think that was when Agilent, then you could like send them what you wanted and then they would actually do it. But before that, we were just like making like a dog array, but it had 30,000 names, but you kind of didn't know what they were. I mean, that was a wild time, but now you're like, you're at this, what, 20 years now post, right? And that's really exciting to not think we were going to be talking about arrays. Can I ask one more thing on the arrays? Like, are you most excited about, and this could be all of them, are you most excited about how, like, the ease of construction, or is it that you're excited to be able to measure a certain thing, or just being able to measure certain things at that E to the 8 type density?
So for us, it's both building arrays with surface chemistries that perform really well. So, you know, with the DNA arrays, those samples, you know, get cleaned up and they get amplified with PCR so that the samples that get applied to the arrays are, you know, reasonably protein free. And all of the problems you get with nonspecific protein adsorption don't really come into play. But you mentioned earlier lectin arrays. We were the lab that created the first carbohydrate arrays. This is back in 2004 or so. I could be a few couple years off on the date.
Awesome.
We created peptide arrays, protein arrays, antibody arrays. And for those applications, having surfaces that resist protein adsorption, prevent the fouling, is critical. And so I really see our work as opening the door to move beyond DNA arrays into other classes of biomolecular arrays and really give us the ability to measure specific interactions and enzyme activities in the sample. So that's a big piece of this. The second is that we've spent a lot of time working on and developing label-free technologies for reading the arrays. And so, as you know, DNA arrays are really read through fluorescence imaging, and you're looking at the presence of activity because there's a fluor that's brought to the surface. We spent a lot of time in the early days with surface plasma resonance-based analysis, which is label-free. But what really, you know, kicked the door down for us was learning how to use mass spectrometry to read our arrays. And that's truly label-free because if something's there, you see it by way of its mass, the molecular weight. And everything has a molecular weight. Every molecule has a molecular weight. And if an enzyme has converted a substrate to something new, a product, almost always that means the molecular weight has changed. And we see that by mass spectrometry. And if something's bound to the surface, now you've got a molecule at the interface that wasn't there, and we can see that by its molecular weight. And so the real magic that happened in our lab, and it was, you know, in part accidental, was this finding that the self-assemble monolayers and MALDI TOF mass spectrometry just was a magical combination that we could analyze our surfaces. And so we named that SAMD mass spectrometry because self-assembled monolayers are SAMs, and we were using SAMs for MALDI, and that gave us SAMD. And that really, close to 20 years ago, opened the door to a technology that's now the global leading technology in label-free assay technology and used by, you know, many dozens of pharmaceutical companies and drug discovery.
Wow.
So it's like I feel like you started off trying to get rid of the protein and you flipped a switch here, and now you're developing surface chemistries for the proteins, right? That's okay. Then do you have to optimize surfaces that get rid of the oligos or glycans, or do you just cut those up?
For us, again, the surfaces we've used, we've made DNA arrays from them. We've made carbohydrate arrays, small molecule arrays, protein, peptide arrays. It's really flexible and oftentimes comes down to having the right chemistries that give us good control over immobilizing or attaching the biomolecules, because we want to control the density. You want the densities of, you know, peptides, for example, to be the same in all the spots, so you can directly compare the signal, the intensity of the signal you get from all the spots, and not have to normalize it. And you want them to be immobilized in ways where they still are folded and active, so that you're measuring what you want to measure. And so all of that has gone into, you know, a lot of work from our group and many others to develop, you know, robust immobilization chemistries that work. And, you know, the Nobel Prize this year in chemistry that went to Carolyn Bertozzi. And, why am I blanking on my friend's name from Scripps? I blanked on it. But, you know, that's the click chemistry, which has been one of the magic developments for immobilization or conjugation. Right.
And so then once you're doing on the MALDI, and this is something I think Osborne and I have gone down, is now you've got a very high, like you've been talking about this high throughput, you can do that very fast, right? Like all the stuff that we think about, like with mass spec imaging, small laser, fast acquisition, you can now do that on this crazy array, right? Is that where you get that high throughput, or is it more to it?
Ben, it's amazing. And I guess I should call you guys Neely and Osborne since you're both called Ben, but it's amazing because when, you know, we work on plates that are patterned in the geometry of either a 384 well plate or a 1536 well plate. So the industry standards that are automated and, you know, everything works around those plates go into the mass spectrometer and get read. But, you know, these spots can each be read in under a second, sometimes a tenth of a second. And so when you scale that over a day, you're doing, you know, many, many tens of thousands of assays you're reading a day and good conditions over 100,000. And if you've got a few instruments reading plates on a big experiment, you know, you're doing a million assays or wells in a week, which is a throughput that competes with the fluorescence technologies that have really been the backbone, the driver in pharma.
That's really impressive. I mean, I think that's always, you know, we talk about it a lot as, you know, how do we get proteomics at that level? And I mean, I think even though MALDI's kind of not what we want, it's the answer, right? I mean, that's the answer, not the LC, no offense LC, but that's really cool. Okay. So if we could, we kind of want to talk about like how you got to where you are, and you don't have to go back to like, I was six and this is why I became a scientist, or this was my first mass spec, but you can go back as far as you wish, but like, how did you get to this point?
Well, look, I'll tell you, I'm going to go back a little bit, not in a lot of detail, but, you know, anybody who knew me when I was in high school, including my teachers, would fall over, you know, with a massive heart attack if they saw where I was today, because I was not on a path where I should have landed here today. You know, I grew up in the southwest suburbs of Chicago, and what you'd call a pretty rough neighborhood. My parents were immigrants from what was then Yugoslavia, but now Serbia. And, you know, growing up, it was always Serbian in my house. Anybody that called on the phone or came over, it was in Serbian. That was my first language, even though I was born here. And, you know, going through high school, I never knew anybody that went to college. You know, my parents didn't. All of our friend and family network that we spent time with, nobody went to college. So when I got to high school, you know, I wasn't a serious student, but I really enjoyed science and math. And I wasn't at a grade school, so didn't have a lot of opportunities to go deep in those subjects. But I did well. I had some of the state competitions and exams I did well in. And when it came time for college, I applied to a couple places, the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, which was the, you know, the top place for us, and then Caltech. And in fact, got into both, wound up going to Urbana because Caltech at that time, you know, like many schools at that time, didn't offer much aid and it was a lot more expensive. So went to Urbana as a chemical engineer, figuring that would put me on a path that I could graduate, get a good job. And that's what I was looking for. But it was the organic chemistry class I took there that I just really got into. I loved the subject. I loved, you know, the idea that you could build molecules through synthesis without seeing what you were building, but you could have that control. And joined a research lab, Steve Zimmerman's lab, And I just spent all my time there. I love being in the lab and, you know, interacting with the grad students and with him and working on research. And it wasn't long after that that I, you know, was really aimed at grad school. And it was especially the case because I learned that, you know, in the United States, you could go to grad school and your tuition is paid and you get a stipend. And so for me, it was, you know, it made my head spin. So I applied and I went to Caltech, worked with Peter Durbin, and had just a, you know, a special time, a fantastic time to spend 5 years focusing on a problem in the lab and having the freedom to, you know, put all of your attention on that and fell in love with research. At that point, I started to know that I, you know, really was excited about an academic career where I could, you know, do my own research, and did a postdoc with George Whitesides because I was excited about taking my chemical biology background and learning how to connect it to materials and surface chemistries, where George's lab was, you know, the leader, and had a great couple years at Harvard with George's group, and then got started my first job at the University of Chicago as an assistant professor in chemistry. And was really at that forefront of being fluent in surface chemistry and materials and in biology. And it really led to, you know, learning how to create surfaces that were mimics of the extracellular matrix and let us study and understand cell adhesion and cell migration with these model surfaces like we use in chemistry model systems. And then extended to the area of bioarrays, what we've been talking about. And it's just been, you know, a fantastic ride. You know, I can't believe that I had the, you know, good fortune to kind of be at the right place at the right time a few times that that led me here.
You definitely, I try not to actually do background research on people, but I did read a little bit about yours, and I even got distracted by, oh my gosh, it was the person at Caltech. But it seems like you had this series of people that were all very focused on, you know, innovation, right? Like, but I he had a quote. It was, I don't want to work on closing a problem. I want to work on opening a problem. And it feels almost like you just kind of hopped between these places that were, they were all pioneers, and maybe that's all science is pioneers, but it really feels like these were real pioneers, right?
Yeah. You know, that's right. I've always been excited about doing something unique. I was just never able to get excited about working on something that, you know, 5-6 other labs were working on in a similar way with a similar approach. You know, the idea is that comes down to a race, who gets there first. But, you know, if the first person didn't get there, the second would have got in there 6 months later. And so at the end of the day, did you really make a difference? Yeah. And you did. I mean, the work is important. It really does open doors. It teaches people. But to me, it felt like, you know, it was important because it kind of opened the door a little sooner. I was more excited about working on projects where nobody else recognized the opportunity, the approach, the way to put things together to kind of start to open the shades and see it. And I've always had that scientific personality of wanting to work on things that weren't yet recognized and where we could bring it. And if we didn't, it might be 20 more years before it happened. Maybe it'd be two. I might, you know, be overestimating our contribution. But my point is, you know, I, you know, as we've gone through a few areas in the group, when they get to the point where others are now kind of excited about them and working, I feel like it's time for us to move on and open the next door and look for the next opportunity that's not yet in play. And that's just been my nature. And it sometimes means that it's harder to, you know, get it to the point where people see it, where you get credit for it, but it's okay because I'm more excited about it.
So how much did, you know, getting home, you know, weigh into your decision being like in Chicago, like, and was that a handicap? Did you, Were you trying to get home?
You know, it's a really good question because I wasn't. You know, I was at Harvard and I had a couple of schools, three schools, contact me to, you know, interview early. I wasn't yet planning on going on the interview circuit. So there were three of them. Chicago was one. They all offered, gave me offers. So I kind of was doing the right thing. And I had the choice of, you know, do I wait a year and do the full circuit and get out there? And I looked at it and I had a couple offers I would have taken, but the Chicago offer was just really exciting to me. And it wasn't because it was in Chicago. That was a good thing, but it was because, you know, the resources that they were going to provide, which at the time were off scale, and the culture of Chicago, which was, you know, a really, just like we know it today, a robust, engaging culture where you get challenged, you know, people really care about what you're doing and want to understand it. And, you know, I just felt like that was home. And so I was excited to take that and get started. And it was I spent 15 years at the University of Chicago as I grew the program and went through the steps before moving over to Northwestern 11 or 12 years ago. But it wasn't that I was looking to come back to Chicago. It's how it worked out. It's worked out well. I like being here. I love the city. But it wasn't the plan up front.
Yeah, that's what an interesting, it made it seem like maybe that was, you were trying to go full circle. Ben and I both have our home cities that are probably handicaps to us for career progression because of, it's, you know, the trying to get there. So I was wondering if that played in. So what do you do when you're not in the lab? Like when you're not in the office, I guess.
And, well, you know, lots of interests, you know, that are in the professional domain, you know, things that I do outside of Northwestern, but, you know, outside of chemistry and engineering and university life, you know, this is interesting. I play lead guitar in a rock band, a cover band.
Yes. And, okay.
You know, COVID did a number on us. We lost a couple people. We're trying to put some things back together, but, you know, play not a lot of shows. 4 shows a year just to get out, but practice every week. And I've loved that.
What are we covering here? Like, are we talking like Black Keys, Led Zeppelin, like hard stuff or? So
classic rock from the 70s through current times. So, you know, Black Keys, Eagles, Zeppelin, Rush, Guns N' Roses. I mean,
yes.
Lots of
are you doing this at US HUPO and can I come? Like, not joking.
Or not, but, you know, we were supposed to actually play at a cancer center event in Chicago, our band, a few years ago. And it got stopped because the, you know, the dean of the building it was going to be in said no live music is allowed. So now, you know, I'm vice president for research at Northwestern. I could have overruled him now, but at the time I wasn't VPR yet. But yeah, but it's been fun. I mean, I've enjoyed that a lot. And I've got 2 daughters who are now in college, but both of them grew up with music at the School of Rock. And it's just been, you know, part of our family, music and performance and it's been a lot of fun. And then the other thing I enjoy, I love reading, you know, outside of science, as well, at home, mostly outside of science and, you know, biographies and histories and current events and, economics and things that I, just enjoy learning from by reading.
Oh my gosh. Are you like a Keynesian? Economic, what is it? It's the Keynesian versus, oh my gosh, I forgot that
economic. You know, it's more the free market, Adam Smith style economics. Okay. And, you know, I see the value in both. You know, I think one thing that we've lost a lot right now in the country is this polarization, which, you know, as soon as you recognize whether someone you're talking to is in your tribe or the other tribe, you either engage with them or you turn them off. And you know, it's too bad because, you know, even people that don't see a problem in the way you see it, you can learn a lot by understanding why they see it in the way that they see it. And it's something that, you know, I hope, you know, feeds back more, because right now we're not in a good spot in terms of seeing that, you know, we all are well-intentioned. If we want what we think is best, sometimes we rely on good information. Sometimes we rely on not good information, but you can't figure that out unless you really, you know, put yourselves in the other person's shoes and try to understand why they see it that way. And sometimes it makes you revise your way of understanding something.
Absolutely. Yeah. Discourse. No, it's, I mean, not quite the same on reading biographies or nonfiction, but I know Ben Osborne and I, we talk a lot about sci-fi. But again, but I think you do a lot of audiobooks, Ben. Oh, okay.
Really bad one.
Well, okay. I'm not joking about this whole band thing, because you're obviously local, and I know US Hupo is listening to this right now and they love music. Just saying. What's your band's name? Like, I got to go back to that. What's the band's name?
Well, it was called Seven Figures because there were seven of us, but you can interpret that in a couple of ways. But Seven Figures was our name. And one of our guys, our bassist, actually was a investment banker, pretty successful, and moved down to Florida at the start of the pandemic, partly for tax reasons with the difference between the states. And then we lost another person. So we're trying to find a couple people to come and fill those roles locally here. So keep going.
Well, I feel like they gave Carolyn Bertozzi like a bass. I saw she got like a bass for something. Right.
She sings apparently at one event I saw, you know, she did a heck of a job singing something. So you're right.
They'd be like the most talented like band ever. I mean, it's like, what was it the other day locally? I met this like famous chef and we were just discussing drywall repair. So yeah, it's like you have all these famous scientists and we're like, let's discuss Led Zeppelin. Like really, how do you feel about John Paul Jr. or like something? Okay, that's amazing. I love it. I was before trying to read about random things about Chicago. So we're coming to Chicago. It's the first week of March. You obviously know things about Chicago. We've had various people share things about the Drake, Chicago. Like what's a... It doesn't have to be a thing we need to do. It can even be a thing we need to know. But give us some like Chicago insight.
Well, look, I think of Chicago in many ways as New York in the sense that it has everything: great dining, great theater, great sports, great outdoor venues to enjoy, and you know, certainly along the lake to walk along the lake, which is a parkland, from south to north. But it's accessible. It's something that you can do and use. So restaurants here are just amazing. Lakefront, if people come, one recommendation we always give is to take the architectural river tour. The river kind of cuts right through the city, and their architectural tours where they explain, you know, a lot of the just amazing architecture that was born in Chicago. And the view you get when you do that from the river, very different than the view you get from the streets. And even I go back every few years and do it again because it's so much fun. So if I were to recommend one thing for visitors that are coming to town, it really would be to take the river architectural tour. Easy to find those online because they really are recognized, and it just gives you an awesome view of the city and, you know, from Daniel Burnham and all the other famous architects that, you know, created their crafts here, you'll see it.
And no one has mentioned that. I'm so glad that we ask everyone on the podcast because we keep getting different suggestions on that. That's a totally new one. Well, you know, out of respect for your time, I think we're about ready to wrap up. So, thank you so much for making time for this.
This has been great. I've enjoyed talking with you too. I'm excited about the Hupo meeting. It's just an incredible gathering of, people doing incredible work, and great to host it in Chicago, and looking forward to meeting a lot of people and all the events that attend it.
Yeah, and we are really excited to have you, and I can't wait to hear your band. So, and thanks for agreeing to that. So at this point, I want to do some credits. The views are that we express are solely our own, not anyone else's. Again, huge thank you for US Hupa for sponsoring us. The intro song that you heard, which you haven't heard yet, Milan, but it's pretty cool, is by Johannes. Kaylee Kirkwood for our artwork. And again, everyone, just subscribe and like or stars or thumbs up wherever you get podcasts. And yeah, we'll see you in Chicago. Thanks again, Milan.
Thanks very much, guys. I appreciate it.